The Guardian.
Plastics began with knife handles and piano keys. Now they play a part in almost everything. Radio and the telephone both depend on plastics.
Earlier this year, the first global analysis of all mass-produced plastics found that humans have produced more than 8.3 billion tonnes of the stuff since the 1950s.
They are all depending on plastic.
And with this figure predicted to rise to 34 billion tonnes by 2050, issues around plastic production, usage and disposal are of the utmost importance.
It is based on the simple law of nature that one chemical process leads to another. For example, grass feeds on water and air, sheep feed on grass and sheep produce wool.
But what is it about plastics that makes them so widespread? Where does most of it end up? And looking to the future, what can be done to address the ever-growing impact of plastics?
So we had about 6.3 billion metric tons of plastic waste produced in 2015. And of that, only 9% of that was recycled.
I think the key step that needs to be taken is to consider the end of life fate of a product appropriately at the design stage. That would solve a lot of these problems.
We find things that we already know we can get from biomass in large quantities, and we base our new polymer industry upon those things so that they're not from petrochemical resources, and we think about the greenness of the chemistry as we go along.
I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
Jenna?
Hi.
Hi, Jenna. Hi.
Before we delve into some of the issues, I first wanted to know exactly what makes plastic so attractive for so many applications.
So my name is Jenna Jambic. I'm an associate professor in the College of Engineering at the University of Georgia, and also a part of the New Materials Institute at the University of Georgia.
Jenna was also one of the authors on the Global Analysis Report, and I spoke to her via Skype this week.
So we're talking here about plastic and the problem we seem to have with the material. But to start with, what do we mean by a plastic? What characteristics do they have, and how are they different from polymers?
I think what is really interesting to me is sort of the history of plastic and why it was invented in the first place, and the fact that the first plastic materials were actually made, from natural materials. And even going back to the word plastic itself used to just be an adjective, meaning something could be easily shaped or molded. But it wasn't until the actual material was invented that it became a noun. And we now, call this material plastic itself. And so some of that history would be sort of in the early 1800s, there was an inventor who made what was called nitrocellulose. And so this is nitric acid and cellulose together, which is very flammable. And so it wasn't until camphor was added to this material, it made it much more stable. And this material was called celluloid. But then it was really when we got into synthetic materials and making plastic from when we're looking at now traditional fossil fuel-based feedstocks that then Bakelite was invented and was sort of the first material made from synthetic materials that, became the plastic as we know now. And the characteristics that are great is that you can mold something into any shape you want. And they're very inert, when they're in use. They don't react with a lot of things once they're set. You have additives. And so all of these, there's thousands of additives. And so it can be, various colors. There can be fillers. There can be textures. It can be various flexibility. It's just, thousands and thousands of actual different plastics that are just amazingly useful in our daily life.
And how does one go about making a plastic? I mean, these are synthetic materials, they're man-made. Well, how does one go about making something? And you talked there about the feedstocks coming from sort of petrochemical background.
Yeah, so that and also natural gas. So both of those are sort of mixtures of all these different carbon compounds. And then we go about refining those into sort of the different components that we would know, for example, coming from crude oil, like the gasoline we use in our cars. And through sort of that refining process, there's something also called cracking. And so you get down to sort of these individual monomers, which are these sort of single carbon compounds. For example, one might be ethylene and one might be propylene. And so to make the plastics, you actually just polymerize those. And so they get up into these long chain carbon compounds. So you end up with ethylene making polyethylene. But ethylene is also the monomer for polyesters and also for polyvinyl chloride. So these monomers are more than just used for plastics, which is why it's so inexpensive and so easy to make them, because these monomers are then the feedstocks for many different chemical compounds that we use daily.
So talk me through a bit about how plastics are disposed of. I mean, when I was a child, I went to a landfill site and was, that was good, what, 20 years ago now? She says, revealing her age. But this was quite a while ago, and I was quite horrified to see things just sort of basically being buried in the ground. Have things moved on generally since then, or how much of our plastics actually end up in landfill still?
So we were just able to recently compile that kind of data globally and sort of look at, you know, the data reported by industry in terms of the production of plastics from 1950 until 2015, and then the production of plastic waste, because basically it's produced and it's used. There's different lifetimes of different products, but the packaging especially basically enters our waste stream the same year that it's produced. So we had about 6.3 billion metric tons of plastic waste produced in 2015. And of that, only 9% of that was recycled. About 12% of it has been incinerated, oftentimes with energy recovery, but not always. And then 79% has really just gone into our landfills, and some of that also leaks into our environment. So we are not doing a good job of recycling at this point. But according to our research, recycling really only delays, as opposed to completely prevents, of course, the eventual disposal need for the material.
As Jenna mentions, a large amount of this plastic can end up in our environment, and no more so than in our lakes, rivers, and oceans.
Hello.
This is Richard Thompson.
I'm Richard Thompson, and I'm Professor of Marine Biology at the University of Plymouth, and I lead a group called the International Marine Litter Research Unit, and you can find my website by Googling it.
I spoke with Richard via Skype, and started by asking him exactly how much plastic ends up in our oceans.
We don't have a precise figure. I mean, on the one hand, if you look at it, it's now difficult to walk on a shoreline anywhere in the world and not find plastic debris within a few meters. And we're finding it at the sea surface, and we're finding it in the deep sea, as well as in Arctic sea ice. But actually trying to put a number on the total amount that's present in the marine environment is really quite challenging. And there's a number of approaches that have been used. So a study by Jenna Jambek, for example, has taken quantities of plastic waste that are produced, and they've looked at the management of that waste. And they would estimate that there could be in the region of 50 million tons of plastic that's escaped into the oceans already. That's quite a big number. If you compare that with data taken from the oceans, taken from the environment, the quantities that are there, you come up with a slightly lower number. And I suspect that the real answer is somewhere between the two. And in a way, although it's important to know how much is there and how to count it, because one of the things we need to try to understand is if we're seeing any improvement or if we're seeing a worsening. But on the other hand, you could argue that actually the absolute number maybe doesn't matter too much, because most people that I ask, whether they're policymakers, members of the public, they consider that the amount of debris that we're seeing at the moment is too much, and that what we want to see is less. And so in some respects, what's critical there is having a reproducible way of getting an index of what's present, rather than agonizing too much about the absolute number.
And can I just ask, I mean, this sounds like a simple question, but how does it all get there? Is this just individuals slinging a plastic bottle into the ocean? Or is this sort of industrial levels of dumping that's going on? I mean, how do we end up with this problem in the first place?
There are a wide range of different pathways and different routes of plastic entering the ocean, which makes it quite a challenging problem. There's no single place that you could plug and say, if we stopped it getting in from X, that would be the answer to it. So yes, some of it is coming from individuals littering, and that isn't necessarily just on at sea or on the coast. It can occur hundreds of miles inland because all of our rivers empty into the ocean, and the ocean's downhill, if you like. It's going to carry all of that plastic debris with it. If you add that up day on day, year on year, we believe that considerable quantities are actually entering the sea. Then, of course, there are industrial spills. Some of the litter that we find in the oceans is coming from the loss of raw materials, of plastic pellets at sea. Some of it's also coming from shipping and from fishing. But if you look at the types of litter that are most regularly picked up in beach cleaning activities, we tend to find that single-use plastic items are some of the most abundant. Depending on how you do the maths, it can be about 50% of everything we find in beach cleans is single-use items, particularly packaging. And so in my view, that's a place where it's important to think about making a start. Because one of the things I kind of say early on is, in my view, plastics aren't the enemy. They bring many societal benefits. And that's what's taken us from 5 million tons of production in the 1950s to over 300 million tons of production today. But if you think of the items that we produce, whether that's a lightweight part in an aeroplane that's going to reduce fuel emissions, lightweight part in your car at home, or even some packaging that's going to extend the life of food and drink and reduce food wastage, those benefits are very clear. But unlike many of the challenges that we face at the moment, the impact that we see in the environment is not linked to the benefit. It's not linked in the same way as if I take a long-haul aeroplane journey, there's going to be an associated carbon emission. If I want to eat fish that come from the sea, there's going to be a depletion of fish in the ocean, however sustainably we fish. If you look at the benefits that come from plastics, those benefits are not directly linked to this emission of debris to the environment.
So talk me through. This is a crucial point, and one we'll cover in more detail a bit later on. But before that, I wanted to know a bit more about some of the effects plastics can have on marine wildlife.
So I think it's important to recognise here that there's a range of different types of harm. There's the harm to wildlife, which is perhaps most heavily documented in the media. We did a report for the Convention on Biological Diversity a couple of years ago now, and that showed that approaching 700 different species were encountering plastic debris in the marine environment. And many, but not all of those encounters, there's clear evidence of potential for harm, including fatalities as a consequence of creatures becoming entangled in plastic or ingesting the plastic. Most of those reports were for fairly large items of plastic, but interestingly, about 10% of all the reported encounters were with what we now describe as the microplastics, pieces less than 5 millimeters in diameter. They're much more likely to be ingested. I mean, research that we've done, we looked at 500 fish taken from the English Channel. We found pieces of microplastic in about a third of those fish. We looked at 10 different species. We found the plastic in all of them, some of them important commercially. But there isn't, in my opinion, in terms of the current quantities that are present there, any cause for concern about human consumption of those fish and shellfish, because the quantities are still very, very low. So it certainly wouldn't stop me wanting to eat seafood and shellfish. But what I would say is that the fact that we're now finding microplastics so widely distributed, not just in the habitats, but also in the marine organisms, is a cause for concern, because the plastics are persistent. They're not going to degrade. They're going to accumulate year on year. So while I'm saying at the moment, I don't have any concerns about eating seafood from a perspective of the microplastics, it could be a different answer that you got from me if we're having this interview in 10 or 20 years' time, unless we change our ways in terms of the quantities of plastic that are entering the environment.
As Richard mentions, these effects can extend further than just the species found in our seas. Recent research has also found that plastic debris can affect habitats and entire ecosystems, not to mention the negative socioeconomic and psychological impacts it can have on us humans. It seems that something has to change. And after this short break, we'll hear from someone who's attempting to tackle the issue.
I'm looking at a couple of materials that are made by fermentation, and they're already made actually through a bio-based route on a large scale, and it's using those materials in new ways to create monomers to then polymerize up to make polymers.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, it attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, be sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we heard from Jenna Jambeck about the rise of plastics, both within our society and, more worryingly, in the environment around us. We also heard from Richard Thompson about a handful of the negative effects we know these plastics can have on marine life. And whilst they both agree that something needs to change, Richard was clear that the real villain in all this may not be the plastic itself, but how we design, use, and dispose of it.
Hello.
Hiya, I thought you were going to call the landline.
This is Dr. Ian Ingram.
I work at the University of York in the Green Chemistry Centre of Excellence. I'm a postdoc researcher, so I'm not quite an academic yet, but I've already got my PhD, so I'm a sort of research scientist, I guess would be the best way to describe me.
I spoke with Ian down the line this week and started by asking him why he thinks plastics are so widespread.
The awesome thing about plastics is that they have a series of properties that you don't get in all in one place anywhere else. And also, it's important to note that plastics aren't one thing. There's a huge variety of different plastics, different polymers used in a massive variety of applications. And there's good reasons for that. They're moldable, so you can make a lot of copies of something with very low waste. So if you imagine making an item out of wood, you end up having to cut away a lot of the wood. You end up with a big pile of sawdust at the end, as well as the product that you wanted to make. With plastics, if you injection mold it, you don't get that. So that's obviously a huge advantage for industry. It's also less wasteful, which is a good thing. They are durable. You know, if you imagine you can drop a plastic item on the floor, it doesn't shatter. That's not always the case with glass. Plastics often resist quite a lot of bending before they become permanently deformed. That's an important application for a lot of the things they're used. They tend to be lightweight. They're water resistant. They don't corrode. You know, you can't put a cup of tea inside a paper cup without coating it on the inside with some form of wax or plastic. So, you know, that water resistance is a huge part of it. The other thing is that we shouldn't forget when we're talking about plastics is they are recyclable. Most thermoplastics are recyclable in some, one way or the other, depending on their form factor and how they've been laminated with other things. And that's an important thing in plastic's favour. You can't really recycle a wooden spoon, but a plastic item is easier to recycle.
So, I mean, the examples you've given there show sort of the virtues of plastic. And in a way, we've got to the point where we've vilified it so much, perhaps we've slightly lost sight of its sort of the wonder material that in some ways it could be considered. But you're working on a project to replace the sort of 300 million tonnes or so of plastics produced each year with alternative materials. So perhaps talk me through what the motivation for that project is. And what sort of materials then are we talking about?
Okay, so my project is substitution of the currently existing plastics that we have around us in the world with more sustainable versions. Now, it's important to say I'm replacing them with plastics. There's a huge amount of applications where other materials are not necessarily suitable. And so my project is to substitute plastics made from petrochemical resources with ones made from more sustainable resources, and also with more thought about their end of life. So there's a couple of concepts that are probably worth introducing here. there's the concept of life cycle analysis. So when you want to judge how sustainable something is, you have to look at it in a cradle-to-grave way. You have to think about where the raw materials come from, what environmental impacts are inevitable in using those raw materials and extracting those raw materials, transporting them to where they're going to be used. You know, do you do a lot of mining? Does that cause pollution of local water sources? Do you do agriculture? Is that displacing another crop that you wanted to grow, maybe food crops? Is it causing cutting down of the rainforest? Are we talking about oil extraction? What environmental hazards are associated with that? There's a huge amount of thought necessary about raw materials. Then you've got the production itself. Does the conditions used in that pose hazards to health? Does it use a huge amount of energy? Is there a huge amount of transport from site to site? All of this kind of thing. Then you've got to think about the life cycle use of the product itself. You know, does it have inherent hazards in it? Is it more efficient than another product? Does it do the job better in some way that has a reduces or increases environmental impact? You've got to think about all of those things. And then you've got to think about what happens to the product when you're done with it. Does it get recycled? Does it get burnt for energy? What is the offset that you get by getting energy back at the end of the product by burning it? You know, if you have a wooden product, you can think about doing that, but you can burn plastics as well. Then you've got to think about, is it recyclable? Does it go into landfill? Does it biodegrade? What happens if it doesn't go in the intended end of life?
And as Ian explains, this all contributes to an idea known as the circular economy.
So the idea of the circular economy is trying to make sure that there's as little waste as possible, and that anything that's waste we think of as a resource, so we try to bring it back in. And whether that's agricultural waste, you know, if we're harvesting peas, what happens to the pea vines? Can we get useful chemical products out of those? Let's not think about plastic as something, oh, we've got to deal with the plastic at the end of its life. Let's think of it as that plastic is a resource that we can use to make either to recycle into more plastic, or we can use for energy, or we can use for a whole variety of different things. So circularizing the economy rather than having it kind of thinking of waste as waste is a big philosophical change that we need to make in order to make things more sustainable. And going hand in hand with that, and really at the core of what I'm working on, is the idea of the bio-based economy. So moving away from petrochemical resources, which is what all of the chemical industry has been based on for 100 years, towards biomass resources, so waste products from agriculture, consumer food waste, that kind of thing.
So just talk me through here some of how you use these materials then to create new sorts of plastics, because it feels like a big jump to go from some of the things you're talking about there to creating these new kinds of materials.
Okay, so there's a few different approaches. You can use some of the polymers and plastics already within the organisms themselves. So cellulose-based materials are a huge area of research, cellulose being the natural polymer, the natural plastic that plants use as part of their cells. Lignin as well, which is a structural material used in trees and woody plants for the reason that it's a very hard, very woody material that they use to support their bodies. And there's a lot of research going into utilizing lignin as a raw material as well. Lignin is incredibly hard to deal with because it is so tough that actually breaking up the chemical bonds within it so we can do useful processing on it is really hard. My personal area of work is in an area called platform molecules. So again, it's quite a big sort of paradigm, big concept that's part of the whole bio-based economy changeover from petrochemical resources. So the petrochemical industry, and plastics are a huge part of the petrochemical industry. They're the biggest user of fossil resources apart from fuels, if you look at by ton. The whole chemical industry uses a handful of base chemicals, things like ethylene, things like benzene, which are extracted from crude oil, and the simple processing done to crude oil to fractionate it and crack it to get to these particular set of base chemicals, which then a huge tree of other products are made from. They're kind of the building blocks, the Lego bricks of modern chemistry, and have been for many decades now. The bio-based economy, we seek to replace those with molecules that are cheap, abundant, and easily extracted from biomass or made from biomass and sustainable resources. I'm looking at a couple of materials that are made by fermentation, and they're already made actually through a bio-based route on a large scale, and it's using those materials in new ways to create monomers to then polymerize up to make polymers. So making monomers from these platform molecules, which are things we can get from biomass from this waste product on a large scale in a sustainable way, we can start to base our new chemical industry on those, and that's particularly what I'm working on. So I'm working on making a whole variety of different plastics. So we're finding a lot of pitfalls and a lot of blind alleys. We're also finding some really new and interesting opportunities. So for instance, at the moment, we're working on a particular class of molecules called itaconic acid. This stuff is made by fermentation. So you take a fungus, you cook it up with some waste sugars, and sugars are available from plants, as you know. And there is a lot of waste sugar that's available sort of after sugarcane extraction, this kind of thing. So they don't necessarily have to compete with food. And there are new strains of these bugs that will work on cellulosic biomass, on straw or on wood pulp or things that are waste products. So we don't have to compete with food, and that's really important. And what we're doing is we're doing some particular chemistry on these to make new monomers. And we discovered a reaction completely by accident called the Diels-Alder reaction, where we took furfural alcohol, which you can make in a couple of steps from, it's actually made from corn cobs currently and commercially, and we ended up with a particular monomer. And there's several different avenues we've branched off on, some of which are to really tailored, really precisely controlled polymers, and they're in a completely new class of monomer for making those kind of polymers, so we don't really know what we're going to do with them yet. But we've also found ways to work on that monomer in other ways, to make more plastics, very much like some of the commercial plastics that are out there. This is very early days yet, and it's not the only class of monomer we're working on, but that's very much how we think about it. We find things that we already know we can get from biomass in large quantities, and we base our new polymer industry upon those things so that they're not from petrochemical resources. And we think about the greenness of the chemistry as we go along.
The hope, then, is that this new polymer industry will be greener in production, in turn leading to widespread environmental and socioeconomic benefits. But it's not just the actual building blocks for these materials that need to be addressed.
I think the key...
Richard Thompson again.
...step that needs to be taken is to consider the end-of-life fate of a product appropriately at the design stage. That would solve a lot of these problems. At the moment, I think we've done a very good job of designing a vast diversity of different products from plastic, products that bring many societal benefits that we've talked about already. We've also done a good job of designing products to make them attractive to the consumer. But really, at the design stage, there's been very little thought put into what are the end-of-life consequences. And you could apply that just as much with the microbeads in cosmetics that we've heard so much about, that really, you know, when a designer was sitting there thinking we want an abrasive to put in our products that's not a natural material like a coconut husk because we want to be able to guarantee the supply, it's fairly inevitable that those particles were going to escape through wastewater treatment and end up accumulating in the environment. So it's thinking about what's the end-of-life consequence of the product I'm designing. In the same way, if I turn to some everyday items of packaging, I've got some plastic drink bottles in front of me. Extend the shelf life of drinks, help to bring us fizzy drinks, absolutely fine. One of the bottles I've got is a clear bottle. One is a green bottle. They're both made of the same polymer, PET, one of our most highly recyclable polymers, and we've known that for over 30 years. And yet, if I ask the recycler which one of those bottles they want the clear one, not the green one, because the presence of that pigment will greatly reduce the value of the recycled plastic. Now, both have got the same logo on them, the same logo labeling to the consumer. They're both, in theory, just as recyclable. But because of a lack of thought at the design stage, a lack of thought for end of life, that is, the inclusion of that pigment is making it not economically viable for the recycler to deal with the bottle. Why is the colouring there? It's not to do with getting the fizzy drink to the consumer. It's to do with marketing. And of course, I've nothing against that. But if that marketing is taking one of our most recyclable polymers and rendering it highly unlikely to be recycled because of the economics, then that seems a real shame. It seems like a real lack of thought has been applied at the design stage. And that's with one of our most recyclable polymers. So I think, you know, it's that incorporation at the design stage of making sure that products are designed with end of life in mind. And it could be that there are different end of lives, recycling in some instances, but it might be that in other examples, degradability, enhanced degradability, could be the way forward. But it's thinking about the specific use and where the end of life is likely to be.
All of these examples point to the complexity of the plastics problem we face, with each aspect a small piece of the puzzle when it comes to the solution. But something I wanted to know was whether these changes should be led by companies, demanded by consumers, or mandated by the government.
I think the reality is that it's a combination of all of those things. And of course, education is really important in all of that. I mean, we could design the best products possible with high end-of-life recyclability potential. But unless consumers actually recycle them, then that's a waste of time. But the flip side of that is also true, that, you know, I get, you know, people local to me, because they know I work on this topic up and down the street, asking me, why is it that they can't recycle a yogurt pot when in a neighbouring county they can do? So it really, in my view, needs to be led from the design stage, that extended producer responsibility to make sure we're designing the end-of-life recyclability. And then I think we can hope to take the wider group of the consumers with us to increase the actual quantity of material that's recycled. And of course, we can use policy measures to help to incentivize that. We can use measures to help to incentivize it at the design stage, and we can use measures to help to incentivize the good practice in recycling. There's therefore a job for all of us.
Sentiment shared by Jenna Jambeck.
We all, I think, need to work together. I think consumers have been trying to do a lot, of course. I mean, globally, as I travel around the world, raising the level of awareness of people, I think, is important. In many cases, plastic has sort of snuck in. So let's say the banana leaf that was used maybe to hold that to-go food that you got is now plastic. And, you know, so throwing it on the ground isn't appropriate, but culturally, that's what you've always done. So when I say spreading awareness, this does not mean, you know, people are always maliciously ending, you know, putting plastic in the environment, but it's happening. So consumers raising the awareness globally and then being able to make those choices, which are not always possible. And I sometimes say we have the luxury, those of us who can make those choices, if your only way to get clean water is in a bottle, then, you know, that's obviously something that you need. And so trying to, you know, figure out what you can do. And so then certainly where people are limited, we need both government and companies to step forward. We need to improve infrastructure globally. Governments, you know, have always been involved in the solid waste management systems. And so, you know, if they can be more proactive. So I think those three players are very important. And I think the balance of how much is needed from each is almost different in different places around the world. But all three of those are really needed at the table. I'm pleased to see more corporations stepping up, but I think that's where we had seen lack of thought previously.
Special thanks this week to Jenna Jambeck, Richard Thompson, and Ian Ingram. This podcast is part of The Guardian's coverage on plastics, so make sure to head over to theguardian.com and search plastics to find out more, including a report by me where I try to spend a whole week without buying any plastic at all. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly. For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.